The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
America, bonjour, hi, Canada, on this Wednesday. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway. A lot of show coming ahead the next 3 hours. I'll be joined by Leader Mitch McConnell later today. Congressman Mike Gallagher will be along. Ohio State Senator Matt Dolan continues the Senate candidates who are running in Ohio. I'll also be joined by Brian Westbury talking about the inflation numbers. Michael Laughlin, the author of Hidden Mercy, will be joining me as well. But first, a rundown of the news. The first American who has died from Omicron has been detected in Texas. A Houston man who had previously had COVID but did not have the vaccine died. Undisclosed underlying conditions as well, according to public health officials in Harris County. But I'm sure it's more than one. They're just not testing people who die the way that they did early on. Omicron is just beginning and Americans are already tired, reports the New York Times this morning. Well, they might be tired, but they're also vigilant. I've noticed a particular drop in behavior among people that I know and family members and travel plans and all that sorts of stuff as people decide just to show as little skin as possible. The good news out of South Africa is where it began to be detected. Doesn't mean it began there, but it began to be detected. Omicron has dropped from 27,000 new cases last Thursday to 15,400 cases yesterday. So their wave is already peaked and is declining because Omicron moves so fast. It's so highly contagious. It sweeps around, finds everyone it can get into and gets them, and then moves on. And so it's moving east to west, and it's all over the United States. So we will be in it, the thick of it, for 2 to 3 weeks. Do your shopping remotely. Great news from the U.S. Army, reported by Tara Kopp yesterday in Defense One, and that is that the U.S. Army has created a single vaccine effective against COVID, SARS, and other variants of COVID. Within weeks, scientists at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research expect to announce that they have developed a vaccine that protects people from COVID-19 and all its variants, even Omicron, as well as from previous SARS viruses that have killed millions of people worldwide. The achievement is the result of almost 2 years of research on the virus. The Army lab received its first DNA sequencing of the COVID-19 in early 2020. Very early on, Walter Reed's infectious disease branch decided to focus on making a vaccine that could work against not just the existing strain, but all of its potential variants as well. Bravo to Walter Reed's Spike Ferritin Nanoparticle COVID-19 Vaccine, or SPFN. Now, I talked to my official toxicologist at the Hugh Hewitt Show last night, and he said, look, that is great news, but they got to run a major trial before you can do any jumping jacks. A major, they got 3,500 people. They got to roll it in. They got to do a phase two trial. But yes, very, very promising. In Israel, it's the first country in the world to make boosters available to the 60-plus. Now, everything happens first in Israel. We should just take our public health cues from Israel. Israel said, okay, we're not messing around. 6 months after your booster, you get another booster. And guess what? That's fine with me. I'll be in line the moment it comes out. If you haven't been vaccinated, go get vaccinated. If you haven't been boosted, go get boosted. President Biden spoke to the country yesterday. This is what he had to say. Cut number three.
Another question folks are asking is, what can you do to make yourself and your family feel safer and be safer? The answer is simple. Get your booster shot. Wear a mask. Our doctors have made it clear. Booster shots provide the strongest of protections. Unfortunately, we still have tens of millions of people who are eligible for the booster shot, but have not yet gotten it. They've gotten the first two shots, but they've not gotten the booster. Folks, the booster shots are free and widely available. Over 60 million Americans, including 62% of eligible seniors, our most vulnerable group, have gotten their booster shots. I got my booster shot as soon as they were available. And just the other day, former President Trump announced he had gotten his booster shot. It may be one of the few things he and I agree on. Let me be clear. Thanks to the prior administration and our scientific community, America is one of the first countries to get the vaccine.
Joe Biden. Bravo. No ifs, ands, or buts. He praised the prior administration for developing the vaccine, and he praised President Trump for getting the booster. And everybody knows that that's the way to do it. Contrast that with some of the other coverage we got. David Muir, ABC World News Tonight, Cut 7.
And the president, in a rare moment, pointing out the former president, President Trump, that he acknowledged he has gotten his booster. President Biden saying he's had his booster, too.
That's good. Chris Hayes on MSNBC, cut number 6.
Former President Trump announced he had gotten his booster shot. Maybe one of the few things he and I agree on.
But All In starts right now.
That's all they get. ABC News, great. Get the word out. Biden and Trump agree. Get the booster. John Berman on CNN, cut number 4.
Ask you about the former president who made some comments over the weekend about his own vaccination and booster status, which were notable because he talked about it in the way he talked about vaccines in general. Let's listen.
Take credit for it. Take credit for it. It's a great, what we've done is historic. Don't let them take it away. Don't take it away from ourselves. You're playing that, you're playing right into their hands when you sort of like, oh, the vaccine.
So he also went on to say that he is boosted. And he told people not to boo the fact that he's boosted. Maggie Haberman reached out to the current Trump team about why he was all of a sudden being public with his messaging on vaccines and boosters. And he replied with a handwritten note. This is what it said. Must tell the truth. Those words were underlined. And then very proud to have produced the 3 vaccines so quickly. Millions of lives saved worldwide. Dave.
Great story by John Berman. Chris Hayes, MSNBC, covered this the right way. Cut number 6.
Former President Trump announced he had gotten his booster shot. Maybe one of the few things he and I agree on.
But All In starts right now.
Okay, so that's I've given you the 4 examples that Dwayne can find from our services of people reporting the straight news. Then we've got Stephanie Rule talking to Yamiche on, I think it was yesterday, maybe it was the day before. Cut number 8.
Yamiche, you said President Biden is not going to convince those who are unvaxxed and dug in to now get the vaccine. However, former President Trump might be able to. Here's what he said yesterday.
What we've done is historic. Don't let them take it away. Don't take it away from ourselves. You're playing right into their hands when you sort of like, oh, the vaccine. If you don't want to take it, you shouldn't be forced to take it. No mandates, but take credit because we saved tens of millions of lives.
Both the president and I are vaxxed, and did you get the booster?
Yes.
I got it too. Okay, so
Does Trump's message matter at this point? Is it something to say I'm vaxxed and I'm boosted?
It's a good question. Based on the focus groups that I've seen, he's sort of in some ways lost control of the Trump supporters when it comes to specifically when it comes to vaccinations, because the president essentially downplayed the virus for so long, said it was going to disappear, said that it didn't need to be, that people didn't need to take it seriously. And now he's trying to convince these same people who essentially listened to him, especially when he didn't tell people that he got vaccinated when he was in office as president. Now he's sort of trying to put the milk back in the carton and say, yes, you should actually follow me. I will say that while President Trump has done a lot of things that are problematic, some criticize him, of course, for racist statements that he said. In this moment, the fact that he said yes to it getting a booster shot and didn't really miss a beat, that shows you that at least with the people around him, that they're telling him this needs to be a clear answer. He could have been very vague. He's been vague in the past. But here you see that even after he got booed, he was trying to explain to people, no, you really need to not think about this. The problem is that, again, it goes back to the people that are most vaccine hesitant in this country are Republican men, Republicans in particular, and they are followers of the president. So this shows you the sort of level of challenge that Biden and really former President Trump have to deal with as they try to convince people to get vaccinated. And it was a tough moment for him. You could see that he was uncomfortable, but also that he in some ways wanted to be clear.
Everything is so much nuance. It wasn't an uncomfortable moment. I've watched it 20 times. He was laughing at a small group of people who were objecting, the anti-vaxxers in the crowd. It's easy to say, yes, that was great. Everyone should know President Trump. People can't do that. They can't give the Yamiche can't give the unqualified yay. Now, those are the only 5 mentions I found. That maybe it will spread out through the media again today. When I criticized legacy media yesterday, it was early. It was before President Biden's speech. Hopefully they lead with it every day. If you think President Trump is a great guy and he got boosted, maybe you'll go out and get boosted. That's what he said. That's what the president said. All around praise for everyone involved in that. The rundown continues. Oxford and AstraZeneca have launched work on an Omicron variant vaccine. Hospitals are scrambling because the only monoclonal antibody, there are three, only one works against Omicron, is in very short supply. That's a head scratcher. We're 2 years into this. We know that monoclonal antibodies work, and they can't get them where they're needed. That's a head scratcher. The NHL is pulling out of the Beijing Olympics. Good. They're doing so, they say, because of Omicron. My guess is they figured out they want nothing to do with the genocide games. The Knesset has okayed a travel ban to Israel beginning tonight because of Omicron. More news, more of the rundown after this. Stay tuned to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hugh Hewitt, we live in a sort of grim era. 800,000 Americans have died from COVID. 100,000 Americans died from overdoses last year. 50,000 died last year to suicide. Those are the so-called deaths of despair. So it's kind of an age of mass grief. We've been here before in the period of AIDS. When I moved to New York in 1980, it had not yet begun to break out, not long after college. When I moved to California, it was not yet a thing, but when I came back to Washington with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt in the early 80s, it began to arrive, and by the time I went back to California in 1989, it was a full-blown panic. It reached a total of 700,000 Americans died from AIDS. In the mid-90s, it was about 40,000 people a year. Now, Michael O'Loughlin has written a new book, Hidden Mercy, AIDS, Catholics, and the Untold Stories of Compassion in the Face of Fear. He sent it to me at the recommendation of Andrew Sullivan, and he joins me this morning. Good morning, Michael O'Loughlin. Welcome and congratulations on Hidden Mercy.
Hi, Hugh. Thanks for having me, and thanks for the kind words about the book.
Now, you know, when you sell a book, you have to say the title seven times, according to Frank Luntz. So every sentence should... Well, I wrote Hidden Mercy for this reason, and as I say in Hidden Mercy, so that people hear Hidden Mercy and they know what to look up. Hidden Mercy on Amazon. So having given you that pro tip, C.S. Lewis said that if you could see grief and it was colored black, that the world would be wreathed in black from space. Do you believe that to be the case of the country in the AIDS crisis?
It was a pretty grim time, like you said in the intro. Like I wrote about in the book, it was a time when people were not only suffering, but they were being ignored by so many parts of society, government, pharmaceutical, the church generally. And there weren't a lot of moments for hope, but what I tried to do was profile those individuals who were stepping up and doing the right thing. So there was a lot of grief and darkness, but there were people who, for many reasons, and in my case, I profiled Catholics who were motivated by their faith, who said we have to do something, stepped up and loved their neighbor as they were called to do by the gospel.
Now, you see, that's why I think it is very timely. We're going to be dealing with long COVID for a long time, and we're going to be dealing with the drug, the deaths of despair and people who are lonely and isolated. But Sister Carol and Sister Mary Ellen in Bellevue, Illinois, Sister Patrice Murphy in New York, Father Bill McNichols in New York, Father Tony McGuire in San Francisco. I mean, you've got a legion of heroes in this book. So tell me why you wrote it. You're a young man. Why did you go back and find all those people who are my age?
Yeah, so I'm in my 30s, and I've been reporting on the Catholic Church and politics and religion in the United States for about a decade, and I realized I didn't know any of this story. And it was important to me because I'm a religion reporter. I'm also a gay man, and I was intrigued by this relatively recent history that just wasn't taught. I didn't learn it from my family. I didn't learn it in schools. I certainly didn't learn it at church. And I realized that there was this vast wealth of information from people who were 20, 30 years older than me that just hasn't been passed down. And I thought there's all this collected wisdom and insight that I think is applicable to all people, a part of our history, and I wanted to capture it before it was too late. And some of the lessons in Hidden Mercy talk about why it's important to step up and do the right thing, even if society isn't quite there yet, even if society is preaching a lot of shame and stigma. And people like Sister Carol and Father Bill really were confident in their beliefs that they were called to serve their neighbors, and they did so through heroic means and with a sense of great humility at the same time.
I also think it's a model for people who look at it, the homeless community, and are afraid of it and don't know what to do. It's there's 70,000 homeless in Los Angeles. That's one city. And don't know what to do. Examples of courage are useful to guide behavior going forward. They are certainly in Hidden Mercy. I want to run down, though, a fair statement of Catholic doctrine. You and I are both Catholics, and that's why I really enjoyed this, but I think non-Catholics will enjoy it as well. I found five doctrines that are relevant in the Catholic Church. Intimate sexuality is reserved for a man and a woman who are entered into a consecrated marriage. All intimacy outside of that, whether heterosexual or homosexual, is sinful, according to the Church, and that sort of intimacy disqualifies participants, Catholics, from whether they're gay or straight, from receiving the Eucharist. Third, Catholics are enjoined to practice kindness and extend comfort to those who are suffering. Fourth, priests should not extend the Eucharist to people they know for a fact are in a state of mortal sin, but they often do. And finally, bishops are obliged to follow the doctrines of the Church. I tried to put those as neutrally as possible. Are those fair statements in your view, Michael?
Yeah, I think you captured Catholic teaching on sexual morality pretty succinctly. That's the teaching of the Church, and certainly it hasn't changed under Pope Francis, because there's sort of a more welcoming tone. And you have to remember, in the 1980s and 90s, as HIV and AIDS coming on the scene, that is what's guiding the attitudes and opinions of many Catholics. So that's what makes the stories in Hidden Mercy even more compelling, because there are Catholics who understand the teaching and then are confronting the reality on the ground. And that's sort of the great tension, I think, within Catholicism, is how do you take these teachings and apply them to real life where it's much messier and doesn't often fall into these clear black and white rubrics.
Well, the one thing that isn't, there is no tension around Catholics are enjoined to practice kindness and extend comfort. Now, my experience in the Catholic Church was St. Matthew's in D.C., where I went often when I lived here in Annunciation, as well as my parishes on the West Coast, were very deeply involved in AIDS ministry. And I think after a period of sort of stunned what's going on, that curve extended. I think your book follows that curve from huh to to oh. You agree with me?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In the early days, it was really underground. I mean, not just in the Catholic Church, but generally, even within the gay activist community, there was this underground movement to call attention to HIV and AIDS. And within the Catholic Church, there were parishes doing really good work early on, but often they had to kind of keep it quiet because it was very taboo. But as we went into the late 80s and then into the mid-90s, during what is basically the height of HIV and AIDS, it becomes more professionalized, more visible. Organizations like the National Catholic AIDS Network begin having big meetings, like at the University of Notre Dame. And it does become seen that the Church is willing to be more of a partner. Now, it was never perfect. There was never this simpatico relationship between the gay rights community and the Catholic Church. But there were areas of overlap. And like I write about in Hidden Mercy, there were individuals who had kind of a foot in each camp and were trying to navigate what does it mean to be someone who adheres to Church teaching and someone who's part of the gay community. And those individuals get profiled as well, because there was this sense that we have to work together to overcome this major challenge facing society.
It seems to me you captured Cardinal Bernardin, who I had great respect for, pretty perfectly. He did both. He both upheld doctrine and he extended mercy. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, so Cardinal Bernardin was the Archbishop of Chicago in the 1990s, and he really tried to navigate both worlds. He understood the need to teach Catholic Orthodoxy, but then again, he wanted to make sure that the pastoral needs of all different communities were being reached, including the gay community during the height of HIV and AIDS. And he was sort of caught in the middle of this tension, like we talked about earlier, between how do we teach what the Catholic Church believes to be the truth while also extending mercy. And he tried his best to navigate that, with some hiccups along the way, but proved to be, I think, a more able partner in the fight against HIV than some other bishops who maybe couldn't navigate these tensions as well.
No, I do love the sisters. Now, I was educated by nuns, and my father was chairman of a Catholic hospital, though he was a Presbyterian in Warren, Ohio, and those nuns that ran that hospital, Sisters of St. Joseph's, they were the toughest people in the world, and they wanted for Christmas whiskey, so he took them whiskey at Christmas. The nuns are just... they're very courageous. They have always been so. And they demonstrate in your book that the rap that they get is unfair. I mean, these nuns are very courageous people. And they go to New York, and I think it's very amusing how they meet the gay community for the first time in New York. And it's really sort of a jarring experience for them.
Yeah, I mean, the nuns have historically been working in the trenches, doing the gritty work of living out the gospel. And during HIV and AIDS, it was no different. So I write in the book about several nuns, but one in particular, Sister Carol Baltashevitz, who was a kind of courageous, battle-tested ER nurse. And she found herself in a pretty small city in Belleville, Illinois, and she started encountering young men dying from AIDS and grew very frustrated because she didn't know how to help. There was just no medicine early on. There was very little she could do. So she and another hospital sister of St. Francis, Sister Mary Ellen Rombach, packed up, moved to New York. They volunteered on the AIDS wards at two Catholic hospitals. They answered calls on an AIDS hotline run by the Gay Men's Health Crisis. They meet gay Catholics who kind of introduce them to the community and help them to understand that they would be valued as partners in the fight against HIV, but they have to put aside their own prejudices and biases. And they move home and open an organization called Bethany Place, which becomes a huge partner in the fight against HIV in that part of the country. And Sister Carol really becomes an advocate for people living with HIV and AIDS, rises up to the State Commission in Illinois. And it was this transformation where she actually had her understanding of her faith expanded through her interaction with the gay community and later women, especially who were affected by HIV and AIDS. And I thought it was an interesting dynamic where Sister Carol had the humility to say, I don't have all the answers, but I want to engage with this hurting community. And ultimately, she says it made her a better Christian. So there are these lessons here where if we engage in this kind of service, whether it's with people with HIV or the homeless, as you mentioned earlier, there is this chance to grow in our faith and understanding. And I think that's an important takeaway from Hidden Mercy.
And Michael, there's a hidden takeaway. You profile some institutions, St. Vincent's Hospital, Bethany House of Hope, St. Catherine Genoa Catholic Worker House, Most Holy Redeemer Church. If institutions are facing difficulty in adapting to a particular new crisis, if they read Hidden Mercy, they're going to find how some of those that did well during the AIDS, I mean, AIDS is still with us. 20,000 people a year die from it. I don't want to downplay that. But if they want to deal with changing circumstances, these are four great examples, and you dug into their histories.
Yeah, and I know that my generation in my 30s doesn't really trust institutions in the same way as previous generations, but I do appreciate the power of institutions, and I think you're right that there is this opportunity for institutions today to look at the challenges we're facing, which you mentioned at the beginning are plentiful, and look at how they can respond and adapt. And there is this sense that leaders have to be willing to listen to communities in need and figure out how to serve them. That might not be that might not involve doing things the way they've always done them, but instead looking to how can we use our resources in new ways. And many of the institutions you mentioned were started by just a couple people.
Yep.
Certainly not the hospitals. Those were founded by Catholic sisters, long legacies. But some of the Catholic worker houses, for example, started off with, just a little bit of money and a willingness to want to be courageous partners, and grew into really important institutions for their communities. Many of them have been closed, but there is a sense that people can step up and do the right thing.
Last comment. Activists need to go the path of the Gay Men's Health Crisis Network, not the path of ACT UP in St. Patrick's. I mean, one is productive, one is not, Michael. The last 30 seconds to you about Hidden Mercy.
Yeah, I think in Hidden Mercy, I profile a wide range of reactions to a crisis that was enveloping society, and I'd let the reader decide what path makes the most sense. But there was a sense of anger and frustration, and people responded in very different ways. So I hope when people read Hidden Mercy, and I think it appeals to a wide range of people, that they'll get some ideas on how to reply to society's challenges today.
Michael O'Loughlin, congratulations. Hidden Mercy, a great book for our times, a great book of history as well. Michael O'Loughlin, the book is Hidden Mercy, available at Amazon.com, bookstores near you. Thank you. Time for me to take my Relief Factor of the day, sponsoring the show. Relief Factor goes with the, not going to cure homelessness or AIDS. It's not going to touch the Omicron or do anything for you on any other kind of crisis disease. It's just nature's anti-inflammatories. And if you're out there walking, working, or doing Christmas things, I talked about turkey elbow during Thanksgiving. Now it's platter back. It's when you reach for the dishes you never get down except at Christmas. I carry in curcumin, resveratrol, and omega. It is a wonderful way to begin every day, and I do begin every day. My voice is coming back, as you can tell. I didn't have COVID. I had the two tests. I don't have COVID. I've got KVID, and I'm almost back to 100%. I'll be on special report tonight, in fact, so you can... I won't be using my voice during the day, so I can be on there, but I'm using my voice to tell you, go get relieffactor.com. Stay tuned, America. Hugh Hewitt for Birch Gold. You can find them at hughgold.com, or you can text my name, Hugh, to 98, 98, 98. Why would you want to do that? Because you know inflation is here. It's not coming. It's here. And you know gold cracked the $1,800 barrier recently. And you know that when inflation knocks at the door of the nation, you want to be in precious metals at least 5 to 10% of your retirement. And the only person that can handle the retirement accounts is a legitimate third-party entity that stores the precious metals on your behalf, maintains them. Not gold stocks, not some option on gold, not a gold ETF. Go and get the real deal with Birch Gold. Now, you can find them at HughGold.com or text my name, Hugh, at 989898. They have an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau. They got thousands of satisfied customers. They know what they're doing. HughGold.com or text Hugh to 989898. That's Hugh. Text it to 989898. Thank you.
It's the most wonderful
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt live inside the Beltway. Looking forward to kickoff in Lambeau on Saturday or Sunday or whatever day it is, because the Browns are going to take, half the Browns are going to take it to all the Packers. I'm joined by inveterate Packer fan, Congressman Mike Gallagher. Congressman, I have in my hand my Browns mug. I'm wearing my Browns. I have the bet. The bet is ready. I think you're giving me the line is 2 touchdowns, right?
That's not the line. We don't have any receivers. Marquez Valdes-Scantling can't play because COVID.
Stop. Let me get the violin out.
We're aligned. We're aligned on this issue. Okay? I come in peace.
Okay.
We've got to fix these dumb COVID protocols that are destroying the end of the NFL season. It makes absolutely no sense. And if it wreaks havoc on the playoffs, I mean, we got an impending disaster on our hands, Hugh. We got to fix this.
I have a solution, which is that the tiebreakers ought to be the total number of player games lost to COVID. Not other injury, just COVID. And so if you're tied for the playoffs, we don't do win-loss. We look at who got their wins with the most COVID hours lost. How's that?
That works for me. But how about if you've been vaccinated or you've had COVID recently, then you can play.
I would agree with that too. Keeping Baker Mayfield out of that game was criminal. And it's just stupid NFL commissioner stuff. Let's talk about the game, though. Here's the bet. If the Browns win, you will wear. And if the Packers win, I will wear whatever gear, all of it, that one of us delivers to the other for the remainder of the season through the Super Bowl.
Every time I come on your show, I would have to wear this gear and vice versa?
Yes.
Okay, that's a deal.
All right, good. You sent me one, but I have to send it to you. Now, I have a message for you, by the way, from a certain senator who heard your bit last week. He said, ask Gallagher if his marathon time is 3 hours and 12 minutes.
I don't run marathons. They're bad for you. They make you skinny and weak, okay? Short distances are where it's at.
Have you ever gone farther than 5K? I'm just curious.
I have run the Marine Corps Marathon before. I don't remember what my time was.
Oh, you don't remember what your time was. Well, his was 312 and mine is 323. So actually, mine was 312 too.
Let's get. If I ever need to slowly jog away from an enemy, I'll call you guys up and ask.
All right. Look, let's get very serious. I just read a long thread from the founder of CrowdStrike, convinced that Putin is going to invade Ukraine. So let's just do it. It's a given. It's going to happen. He's coming in with everything he's got. They use little green men. Do we have any little green F-35s that we can use?
We have without straying into the classified realm, we have a lot of capabilities that we can deploy. The only thing that is preventing it is the tepidness of the Biden administration. The fact that in many cases they were unaware of certain shipments of anti-tank missiles and other weapons in our arsenal, they sort of had the wrong things in the queue to be sent to Ukraine. And I think there's just in general a fear of provoking the Russians any further within the Biden administration and a fear of putting our European allies in a bad situation. I don't think people appreciate how utterly dependent Europe is on Russian gas right now. I mean, Europe is going through an energy crisis. Natural gas is trading at $340 barrel of oil equivalent. The average was below 50 before. If Europe has a winter like 2010, 2011, they would run out of gas. We're talking utter chaos. No gas-fired power plants, no gas to heat homes, no gas to cook. So I think Dmitry's analysis was the best I've seen out there yet, but I would even put the timeline earlier. I think if Putin wants to invade, we're talking early January, not late February. The final thing I'd say, Hugh, and I think this relates to the fact that Biden has been caught so flat-footed by this crisis and has failed to put forward meaningful steps, either in terms of deploying military capability to Ukraine, canceling the Nord Stream 2 sanctions move, which was a massive gift to Putin, or imposing actually meaningful sanctions. I think all of this adds up to the fact that Putin has examined President Biden and he's found him to be weak. Between Biden's mistakes and Germany's subservience, Putin thinks he has a narrow window to achieve his goal here. He's either going to gain territory in Ukraine or force a diplomatic solution that would see NATO pull back from commitments to Eastern Europe and potentially fall back into Russian orbit. And you can guarantee that China is watching all of this goes on. We've seen recent reports of enhanced Russian-Chinese cooperation. This is a very precarious situation that has been induced by bad policy moves by the Biden administration, as well as a general sense of weakness that we're projecting abroad right now.
Well, now, I want to suggest what I think we could do if the president or Secretary Blinken or Jake Sullivan were to stand up and say along the lines of, we are impressed with Ukraine's cyber ability. I think they can blinker out Volgograd. We are impressed with Ukraine's drone capability, which they've built up over 5 years. I think they're going to be able to specifically strike many, many hundreds. If we just credit to Ukraine the capacity to do things, which they may or may not be able to do, but which we can do in the little green man form, we ought to be crediting them with that capacity as a means of escalating quietly. What do you think of that, Mike Gallagher?
I agree 100%. We could also expand our little green cybermen, for lack of a better term, our defend forward teams that we've really perfected in the last 5 years, learning lessons in some cases based on what Russia has done to Ukraine in the past, to give and help the Ukrainians with cyber capabilities that allow them to punch back, particularly as we know, and as Dmitry pointed out quite well in his Twitter thread, the Russians are already preparing the battle space in cyber right now. We have to both defend the attack surface in Ukraine itself while also punching back against the Russians in cyber. We have the ability to do that. We still have the most capable offensive weapons. What we don't have is the will to deploy them fast enough in a way that would be effective right now. So there's a whole host of things we can do. The obvious things are, anti-tank weapons, anti-air weapons, and you mentioned certain drone capabilities that we have. But all of it, again, flows from the will of the White House to actually stand up to Putin and impose costs right now, as opposed to waiting until after the fact, waiting until after a coup in Kyiv to then sanction Putin, at which point he won't care. And again, he just has such enormous leverage when it comes to energy policy in Europe and the United States now that I think he's increasingly emboldened. And that's the final thing. I hate to keep coming back to this, Hugh. One of the biggest gaping holes in the Biden administration's emerging grand strategy is their nonsensical approach to energy production. I mean, their policies domestically designed to punish American producers are effectively a massive geopolitical gift to America's enemies, Putin foremost among them right now. And until they fix that basic contradiction, we're going to be struggling to project power and bolster American deterrence in Eastern Europe, in Indo-PACOM, and throughout the Middle East.
I've got to point out, I have here the Financial Times this morning, ships carrying natural gas head for Europe. They're turning around, bound for Asia and heading for Europe because of that price jump. And Angela Merkel is overseeing the closure of three nuclear plants that are perfectly functioning this week in Germany. So, Congressman Gallagher, do you think the Ukrainians can blink out enough of Putin's wealth right now, disintermediate his funds right now as a shot across his bow, because he and his buddies could stand to lose billions? And will they have the capacity, the Ukrainians, with or without NATO assistance, to shut down power plants and hard infrastructure in Russia in the early days of an invasion so that the cost is felt by the Russian people?
Well, I think with the assistance of the United States, there are certainly a lot of ways in which we can impose real costs on Putin and his Kremlin cronies. It's hard for me to quantify that exactly, and it's hard for me to predict exactly how that would affect Putin's behavior, because look at the ways in which Putin has created a situation in which is going to be very difficult for him to back down and save face. And that's why I ultimately believe an invasion is somewhat inevitable at this point, just based on everything Putin has said. But there are ways in which we, working with Ukrainians on the ground, can impose very serious consequences financially on Putin and his cronies, and we should be exploring all of those options. When it comes to the energy side of the equation, yes, we can do a lot of steps to harden our defenses as well as go on offense. But again, I just don't think people appreciate what it would look like if Russia shut the gas to Europe. You'd have thousands of people freezing to death. You'd have economies grinding to a halt. And the Europeans have put themselves in this impossible situation. I mean, shutting nukes, effectively outsourcing energy policy to Swedish teenagers, the whole thing makes absolutely no sense. And that's what's complicating our ability to project a united Western response in this crisis. And then to repeat a point I made earlier, Biden adding insult to injury or compounding the error by waiving sanctions on Nord Stream 2 and effectively indulging in this nonsensical policy of energy surrender to Russia. So the whole thing is very complex, but we do have tools we can use in order to punch back. Everyone always says, well, Putin's playing a weak hand. Well, he's playing it very well. But if indeed his hand is weak domestically, let us exploit that. We have a strong hand that we're playing poorly.
Trump had in place rules of engagement in Syria, and we punched back, and they never hit us again. And so I'm hoping that we have rules of engagement in Ukraine the same. Congressman, I want to close by going back to the game this weekend on a lighter note. What's the weather going to be like up in Lambeau? Because actually, bad weather favors us, the Browns, the good guys, the Cleveland Browns, the older franchise with the more NFL championships.
I haven't looked at the weekly forecast. I should know this, but just assume it's going to be cold. We got a little bit of snow yesterday on the ground here. I'm going to be praying for a lot of snow.
I want a whiteout, man. We got Nick Chubb.
We got the quad father, A.J. Dillon, who's going to be pounding for 7 yards a carry. Even with a depleted roster and an offensive line that has a bunch of rookies and no names, we're dominating right now.
Have you not heard of Mr. Myles Garrett and Mr. J.O.K.? Have you not heard that we are going to shut you down and that I think it's going to be a low-scoring 14-3 game that the Browns are going to dominate on defense. But Nick Chubb, 100-plus yards. We need Baker back, but we'll be fine. I'm looking for – remember –
you're going to look good in green and gold, Hugh. You're going
whatever I send you, T-shirt, hat – you got to wear, right?
Yes. Saying yes. The reverse is true.
Through the Super Bowl. All right, Mike Gallagher, have a Merry Christmas to you and your family. Have a wonderful one. We will be enjoying the game. A lot of Americans need to do just stay home and enjoy the game. Stay away from Omicron out there. America, it's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Brian Westbury, official economist of the Hugh Hewitt Show. Westbury on Twitter, WESBURY. He's with First Trust Portfolio. Brian, good morning to you. Merry Christmas. I know you celebrate the Feast of the Lord's Birth, but I'd like to know if you're celebrating what the market is doing, because it went up really big after going down really a lot. And then I read that we're basically back in the COVID economy. Everybody's shopping from home. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, Merry Christmas to you, Hugh, and to everybody out there. I wrote this weekend, we're all Keynesians now.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. And so just so everybody understands what that means, Keynesians, actually, we've gone way beyond Keynesianism these days, but I actually feel bad as an economist, because what we do is we analyze what the government is doing. Are they going to spend $122 billion here and spend it and print $250 billion there and add it to the economy, rather than what are entrepreneurs doing? What are business people doing? What are consumers doing? Because in reality, an economy is made up of people, not the government. And so anyway, just, you know, if you look through COVID and all the spending and all the money printing that we've done, you kind of have to be a Keynesian. And so,
you know, Brian, I tell people that the government is acting like the fellow who arrives, the paramedic who arrives on an accident scene, puts a tourniquet on the wrong limb. They're hurting the part of the economy that's healthy, and they're not stopping the bleeding where it's occurring.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And plus, they're putting morphine in everyone.
Yes, yes. He's self-injecting as he applies the tourniquet to the wrong part.
Yes, I totally agree. So here, you know, here, like, just to put it in, you know, I guess layman's terms, if you will, we're going to have 5.5% growth for 2021, one of the best years we've had since Reagan. However, a lot of that is government spending. But in 2022, we're going to end up with 3.5, 4% growth. Here's the problem: we're going to have 4 to 5% inflation, and so the bottom line is the inflation problem from, you know, putting the tourniquet on the wrong limb and from giving morphine is going to end up drowning any positives that come out from opening up the economy.
And you know, Brian, I was just talking with
really
Congressman Gallagher.
Me.
Natural gas in Europe has gone up from $50, whatever the unit is, to $350. That goes into their production. That comes back to us. I don't think inflation is going to be 4 to 5% next year.
What do you think it's going to be?
7, 8, maybe higher.
Okay. I guess, yeah, you may be right. You actually may be right. We're you know, kind of holding our guns right now. I didn't think 7% this year. I thought 5, and we beat it, and we probably could next year. Look, when the federal government tries to run the economy, they run it into the ditch. And so we'll see.
Well, here's my reason. I'd like your take. Everything involves energy. Energy is freedom. Energy is productivity. Everything involves energy. We have taken not just inflationary causing monetary measures, but we've driven up the cost of energy worldwide, and we've done it in record time.
Yeah, no. Yeah, and that is, you know, one of the amazing things about all of this is we live in internet time, right? So you think, well, the government can make some mistakes and we pay a price, but it takes time. This time, what happened is it all happened at once. And we're right now at almost 7% inflation. Hugh, I'm just hoping, like, I look at COVID, Omicron. Like, did God give us a variant that is less deadly but protects us? Maybe he did. I'm not trying to play God. And then did he give us a government where the mistakes show up so fast that they lose, you know, when it comes to the voting booth?
Well, you know, we're never going to make that into Miracle on 35th Street, Brian, but that's a good prayer.
It may happen, Hugh. It may happen.
That's a good Christmas prayer. Lord, let us see what is going on here.
Omicron is Christmas. Inflation is Christmas. We look at these bad things, and we move on, and we get better.
That's why I love talking to Westbury. He can find a pony in there somewhere. He's like my old boss, Reagan. Westbury on Twitter, First Trust Portfolio. I'm coming back. Leader McConnell joins me next hour, as does Matt Dolan, State Senator in Ohio, running for Senate. Don't go anywhere, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific,
They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway live. At the bottom of the hour, I'll be joined by GOP leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell. Hoping to join Leader McConnell in the GOP caucus next year is Matt Dolan, state senator from the great state of Ohio, seeking the GOP nomination. Good morning, Senator Dolan. Merry Christmas to you.
Good morning, Hugh. Merry Christmas to you.
I want to begin with a question that I asked five Minnesota gubernatorial candidates last Wednesday night and Josh Mandel this week, and I want to frame it exactly the same way. Did President Biden win the constitutional majority in the Electoral College? If yes, how definitive is your conclusion? If no, please explain which states you think are in dispute and why.
The answer is yes. And look, the Constitution, on January 6th, the Constitution required the Congress, the Senate, and the House to certify the election. So I don't know how, if you claim you're a constitutionalist and you're following the strict letter of the law, you needed to certify. Otherwise, turn the elections over to the federal court, branch of government.
All right, look, that's all I needed. Thank you, Senator. I just asked everyone the same question. Now I want to talk to you about infrastructure. Rod Portman negotiated and Leader McConnell assembled 17 Republicans to pass the infrastructure bill. I had a quick aside to President Trump last week. I liked the infrastructure bill. I would have voted for it. He didn't like the infrastructure bill. I did. What did you think about it and what's your opinion on it?
So I like the infrastructure bill negotiated by Rod Portman, and I'm the only candidate on the Senate side who supports it. This is a bill that is targeted, and it will help Ohio. I mean, think about what this bill does, Hugh. We haven't had an infrastructure bill on the federal level in years, and what this bill does is it allows skilled trade workers, middle-class jobs all over the state to be involved in projects that will last years. These are not one-off projects. These are significant projects. If you're in Cincinnati and that Brent Spence Bridge, finally, after years of both Democrats and Republicans saying we need to fix it, finally it's getting done, those are significant jobs that will pay off in the short term, 6 to 10 years of the work. But then think about all the economic development that the bridge brings. 3% of our GDP goes across it. Same with Appalachia. If you're in Southeast Ohio, and you say you're for economic development, which I am, I'm the only one that can look them in the eye and say, I supported your broadband, because that's going to bring telehealth. That's going to bring education and jobs to the area. You know, it's all over the state. Dayton with their public transportation. Cleveland with our rails and our ports. Columbus with I-70 and 71. I mean, if you've been in Columbus, you've sat in that traffic. You know how debilitating that can be to the economic growth.
Well, let's cut to the chase, though. What's in it for Warren? I talked to Bernie Marino last week. I read a story about Louisville. They are building Amazon warehouses in Louisville because they have energy, workers, and water. Well, we have more energy, more workers, and more water in Youngstown, Warren, but we're not getting the Amazon stuff. Will the infrastructure help?
It will help, but the reason it helps is because it's part of a larger focus that we need to get back to. And I'm the only Republican in this race who has experience who can back up what I'm saying. You need to be laser focused on the development and the representation of Ohio. You picked up on something really big. We have water here. We should be using it as an economic development tool all over the state. We shouldn't be losing out to Kentucky on projects that require energy. We have multiple sources of energy in Ohio, and I've been focused in the state Senate on promoting both. All of the above energy, making sure we have a water economy. But infrastructure is huge. We sit 600 miles from 60% of the United States population. We are the epicenter of getting products out.
Can we talk about water for a moment? Because people don't get this. The 80% of the surface water in the United States is in the Great Lakes. We've got Lake Erie. We've got the most of Lake Erie, and we can fend off Michigan because they're incompetent. So we can use that. Why don't we sell that? I mean, Ohio should be, anyone who wants water guaranteed in the years ahead needs to come to Buckeye Land.
Absolutely. That said, But the thing, you know, if you don't mind, I'm going to talk about why I had an instrumental part in that.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
I saw that as well. I saw where Ohio could thrive, and that was with water. So when I was in the House of Representatives in the state, I negotiated the Great Lakes Compact, which said, look, we know what a great asset we have, so if you want to access it, you come to Ohio. You come to the Great Lakes region, and your company can thrive. We're not shipping our water to you. And we're starting to see that happen. But we need to be more aggressive. We need to make sure that in Washington, when I'm in the U.S. Senate, that we do not deviate at all from diverting Great Lakes water. We represent Great Lakes region with every strength and every ounce of energy to know that that is a source of economic development here in Ohio. It also will create those jobs I talked about that the infrastructure will create.
Let's talk about the dark side, Senator. 100,000 overdose deaths in the United States last year, a disproportionate number of them in Ohio. The west side of Warren is a pretty bad, bleak place right now because of that. I stay in touch with this. Rob Portman has been a leader on fentanyl and stopping it and treating it. What's Matt Dolan going to do?
So what I've done in the state Senate is introduce some bills that deal with a whole host of issues. It deals with law enforcement to make sure that we are cracking down on the dealers. I'm the only one in the race that has any prosecutorial authority. I've done it in the past. We are also working on rehab issues. But let's focus on where the real issue is right now. And, I'm not one for big hyperbole, but what I know is happening right now is fentanyl is coming into the state of Ohio because our borders are open. And if we don't address that issue, it's going to be a never-ending battle with these opiate deaths. We've got to secure the border. And the Biden administration has allowed this border crisis to happen. And we need to send, I need to get in the U.S. Senate, be in the majority, and be able to start implementing policies that we know who's coming into our country and we know what they are bringing. If you talk to any law enforcement, I talk to them all over the state. I talked to them in my role as prosecutor years ago. I've talked to my role as legislature, and I've talked to my role as candidate. And they will tell you that the flow of fentanyl into Ohio is scary. They've never seen anything like this. So
Wow. There
is a point we can address it, and that's at the border. And the things I've done in the state to make sure that the police have the tools necessary to crack down on the dealers and to make sure that the people who get addicted, we can get them clean. We need to get them clean, and we need them to stay clean. Because that's where the deaths come.
Last question, Senator. I told Bernie Marino, who was on last week, I don't let people beat up on my buddy Tim Ryan because he's a friend, right? He's wrong. He's not rotten. He's a good guy. Quarterback for the Penguins. Wonderful guy. I went to Warren Kennedy. But he got to lose, right? So why are you better positioned than the other five? Because we don't get the majority without Ohio. Why are you better positioned than the other five to beat Tim?
Well, politically, policy-wise, I'm the only one who can address Ohio issues and go to Washington with experience to fight Ohio issues. Politically, I'm the only one that's been on the ballot that can prove that I can get independent votes. I outperformed President Trump by 11,000 votes two times, which means I can get Trump Republican votes and I can get the all-important independent votes that are necessary to send me to Washington.
What about cash? You know, this is going to be the most expensive race in Ohio history and maybe the history of states not named California. Are you going to be able to compete?
Yes.
And how? I mean, I think, doesn't Bernie have $1 billion to burn?
I don't know what my opponents have, but I know that I have put a plan. I have a great team, and we are going to be able to execute on a plan that's going to win.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Matt Dolan. I appreciate your coming on the week before Christmas. Enjoy it with friends and family. Have a good Ohio Christmas, and we'll talk in the new year.
Thank you, Hugh. I appreciate it. Merry Christmas to you as well.
Thank you.
Chestnuts roasting.
Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live inside the Beltway on this Wednesday. I'm joined now by the GOP leader in the United States, Senator Joe, oh, he's not here yet? Okay, Senator Mitch McConnell. We're standing by waiting for Leader McConnell to join me. I want to repeat to everyone the president's message yesterday. Go and get your booster. Just heard from son number two. He's got the virus as well. And so luckily he's got a vaccination. It's going to go everywhere. So both of my boys have had it. My daughter have had it. And they are all vaccinated. So the vaccinations minimize the impact of this disease. I'm joined now by Leader McConnell. Good morning, Leader. Welcome. Merry Christmas to you.
Good morning, Hugh. Merry Christmas to you as well.
We have not forgotten Mayfield or the surrounding areas on the Hugh Hewitt Show. How is the rebuilding and the relief effort going?
I think the relief effort is going very well. The problem in all of these situations where you get hit by a tornado or have any other catastrophe is when after about a month, people still got a lot of problems, and they are worried that they're going to be forgotten. So we're going to stick with them until we get Mayfield rebuilt and get it back to normal. Same for Dawson Springs. Worst tornado we've had in terms of loss of life probably in our history.
Yeah, it was devastating. I'm glad to hear the focus will continue. It helps that the GOP leader is from Kentucky. Senator, you served with Senator Jim Jeffords, the late Jim Jeffords of Vermont. He was a three-term senator. You served with him his entire three terms. Did his jump from parties in the spring of 2001 surprise you when it happened?
Well, he was very, very uncomfortable on our side. Vermont, of course, had become what it is today, a very, very liberal place. It was a shock, but not a total surprise.
Now, I don't believe he had been publicly abused in the way that left-wing progressives are publicly abusing Joe Manchin, was he? I mean, it was a quiet disagreement with President Bush over, I think, special education funding that was the last straw, but no one abused Jim Jeffords.
No. Everybody on our side was courting him because we were always fearful he'd do exactly what he ended up doing. So, no, I mean, we certainly didn't do anything like the White House did to Joe Manchin the other day, basically calling him a liar. It was astonishing. Usually when you've got a member who's a little bit out of sync with everybody else, you give him a lot of love. They did exactly the opposite.
Have you spoken with him or written to him about whether or not he might want to cross the aisle like Winston Churchill and Jim Jeffords did?
Well, as I've said the last couple of days, I've had this conversation with him off and on for a couple of years. We come from states that have a lot in common that have become increasingly red over the last decade or so. And I think what Manchin is discovering is that there just aren't any Democrats left in the Senate that are pro-life and terribly concerned about the debt and deficit and inflation. So he feels like a man alone. If he were to join us, he'd be joining a lot of folks who have similar views on a whole range of issues.
He'd also, would he get to keep his chairmanship of energy? Energy is a big deal for West Virginia. He's chairman right now. If he switched over, would the gavel stay in his hands?
That's something we talked to him about. Obviously, he, I'm sure, enjoys being a chair of the committee. It's important to West Virginia, and all of those things are things we discussed.
So let me turn to hard infrastructure. I love your spinach and sugar analogy. I saw you use it with my friend Guy Benson the other day. I want people to hear that as well. The hard infrastructure bill that you helped pass, Rob Portman, Susan Collins, 17 Republicans, and I agreed with it. It meant a lot in terms of what it's going to get done, but it also meant a lot in the politics of getting Build Back Better killed. Can you explain that to people?
Yeah, I mean, initially the Democrats knew, the poll data was clear, what was popular was hard infrastructure. 75% of people believed that we needed to deal with deteriorating roads, bridges, and expand broadband. That was the popular part. And so I liked the approach in the Senate of putting together a bipartisan group. The president ended up agreeing with that. to deal with the popular part of it, which I've described as the sugar, leaving the Democrats to see if they could pass the spinach. And as we ended the year, it looks to me like they couldn't swallow the spinach. Now, I know Schumer said last night on a call he's not giving up. I don't expect him to. But the worst of BBB, it appears to me, is dead.
It does to me as well, and congratulations on that. It's it was great strategery, as former President Bush liked to say. I want to turn to senators. They have different career paths. Some are looking down the street at 1600, and some are looking at Mitch McConnell and want to be leader someday. John Thune's actually been in both positions. I read a story that got me upset that John Thune might be thinking of retiring. How do you say it ain't so, Joe, in South Dakota, Leader McConnell?
Well, John Thune is an outstanding senator. He's done a great job as whip, which is our number two position in the Senate. It would be a real setback for the country and for our party if he retires, and I certainly hope he won't.
Now, the long game that you wrote your memoir about, that's the title, make a great Christmas present for people who want to understand it. The long game, as you told Guy, is always about the next vote and the next election. How do you feel if we keep Senator Thune? How do you feel about getting back to 51? Certainly we'll be there if Joe Manchin switches party, but if the GOP doesn't get Manchin, do you still get to 51?
I think we're going to have a great cycle. The atmosphere is terrible. We've come a long way since the beginning of the year. The president started out the honeymoon period. They were able to jam through the so-called rescue package with $1.9 trillion, which ended up being a huge mistake. And now they've witnessed the incompetence of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the difficulty in convincing people to get the vaccine and the booster, which, by the way, is extremely important if we're going to get through this COVID experience we're having. And then they tried to pass this reckless tax and spending spree, which doubles down on the single biggest problem their earlier bill created, which is rampant inflation, driving the cost of everything up. This administration is in a deep hole, and Hugh, I have a hard time seeing how they get out of the hole by next November. And why is that important? The first midterm of any new president tends to be rocky. Only three times in American history has the party of the president gained seats 2 years into a first term. Usually they have the experience Bill Clinton did and Barack Obama did and Donald Trump did. And I think we're going to have a great atmosphere in which to run. I know what a real minority looks like. We were only 40 after Obama got elected. We got 50. I think we're going to have the wind at our backs and a good chance of getting the majority back.
Let me ask you a little inside baseball here, Leader McConnell. You respected the blue slip rule for district courts. If you didn't have both blue slips for a district court nominee, that nominee did not get a hearing. Is Chuck Schumer respecting the blue slip rule for district courts?
He is, and I think that's the right thing to do. That's been a strong Senate tradition over the years. And so and we honored the blue slip, as you indicated, at the district court level during the Obama years.
So
during the Trump year.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. Now, let me talk to you about real inside baseball, reconciliation. The budget last year passed by Bernie Sanders allowed for reconciliation to pass with a majority. That's what BBB needed and did not get. I don't know how long that stays in effect, and I know there'll be another budget, or I expect there will be another budget. When the window is either open or reopens again, they get a second bite at the apple. Which tax provisions, all of them ruinous, do they seem most attached to bringing back from the dead because Americans have got to plan?
Well, they've still got this vehicle. And Schumer announced last night, according to what I read this morning, that they're going to continue to try to find some version of it that will appeal to Senator Manchin and Senator Sinema. And also they're continuing this fixation with what I call the Democratic big lie, that states are involved in changing their voting laws to make it more difficult for people to vote. That's just simply not happening. What's really going on is the Democrats want to take over the way we conduct all of our elections in this country. In other words, federalize how we do all elections. And we've avoided that throughout the history of our country. You know, each state ought to craft its own election rules, with one exception, the Voting Rights Act. It's against the law to discriminate against people in the voting process on the basis of race. No one is doing that. If they do, it's against the law and can be prosecuted. There is no rationale for the federal takeover of elections other than the Democrats want to make it easier to cheat, frankly. They want to make sure states can't have photo ID at the polls. They want to guarantee that states can have what's called ballot harvesting. That's where you run around and pick up other people's votes for them and turn them in. They don't want even the most modest security measures that guarantee that each of us only have one vote. So that's what we'll also be confronting once again. We've shot down several versions of it earlier this year, and it appears as if we'll be dealing with that again.
Leader, do you think that stepped-up basis, which the Democrats wanted to repeal and drop that, is sufficiently radioactive that it will not be resurrected next year?
Yeah, I think it's dead. It didn't even make it into the House pass version, which is, of course, a total monstrosity.
All right, let me ask you about Senator Manchin again. I listened very closely when he was on Fox News Sunday with Bret Baier on Sunday. In fact, I taped it and listened to it twice. It seems to me the filibuster is safe, even though he is continuing to talk about how to get what he thinks are good improvements in voting rights passed. And I believe Senator Sinema has restated her opposition to filibuster change. Do you believe the filibuster is safe for the rest of this Congress?
Senator Kirsten Sinema has been unequivocal in support of the filibuster. For your listeners, that prevents radicalism. The reason the Democrats want to get rid of the filibuster is they want to admit two new states, the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and pack the Supreme Court and fundamentally change the structure of America forever. Filibuster prevents extremism. It's always frustrating when you're in the majority and wish you could do everything you wanted to. The Senate was designed to make it difficult to have radical change in the country unless there are huge majorities on one side or the other. So it is the essence of the Senate, is the legislative filibuster, and I admire and respect Senator Sinema and Senator Manchin for saying they are not changing it.
Let me move abroad in my last two questions, Senator McConnell. Earlier today, one of your colleagues sent me a pointer to a line of thinking online that Putin is committed to the invasion of Ukraine. And that's a terrible thing. When it happens, does the United States have the equivalent of little green men, either little green cyber experts or little green F-35s that we can help Ukraine with?
Well, let me say what we ought to do is give the Ukrainians the ability to fight. There's some people in the State Department, I think, in this administration and maybe in the previous one, who felt giving the Ukrainians the ability to fight is somehow provocative to the Russians. I would give them equipment that allows them to take it to the Russians if the Russians invaded. Second, I would increase military personnel from NATO in Poland and in the Baltics, not only our own troops, but troops from other NATO countries. So, because countries like Poland and the Baltics have had a lot of bad experience with the Russians going back a long time and are extremely nervous about this. I hear the Ukrainians are ready to fight, and if they're ready to fight, we should make it a fair fight by trying to help them defend themselves.
And would that extend, in your view, to assets which are not officially the United States, but which are made available to them that are, especially the cyber? I'd like to see them blink out Soviet Russian nuclear power plants and blink out Russian energy plants and make it very cold in Russia. And the Ukrainians have a pretty healthy cyber sector. Do you think they can do that with or without assistance?
Look, there are a number of tactics that we could employ, and among them are some of the things you suggested. I hope and I expect the president's made it clear to Putin that that's a possibility as well.
Leader McConnell, I appreciate your time. Have a Merry Christmas. Our best wishes to the people of Mayfield and the surrounding communities, and I look forward to talking to you in 2021. Well done. Well played, Mr. Bond, as they say, on the Better Build Back Better fiasco. It's dead, and I hope it stays in the grave.
Great, you. Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you as well.
Thank you, sir.
The weather outside is frightful.
Welcome back, America. More frightful than the weather is the Senate Democrats still have the majority. And Leader McConnell just told me they intend to come back. The reconciliation window is still open. I'm joined by Charlie Dombeck of Key City Capital, a sponsor of this show. This is a sponsored segment. And Charlie, I got to tell you what the leader just told me. He expects they're going to make another run at the tax bill. He does not think that stepped up basis will return. He thinks that the idea to repeal that is dead. What worries you the most that might come back like Frankenstein's monster out of the grave of Build Back Better?
Well, you know, there's a number of things in the Build Back Better legislation that are troubling. One is the $80 billion investment in the accounting police to scour our 1040s for additional revenue. I don't think that is healthy government. There are a number of things on the retirement side that are troubling as well. The elimination eventually of the ability to do a conversion to a Roth IRA. I love the ability to help clients ultimately develop a tax-free bucket of wealth. Most people don't get the opportunity to do that to make too much money, but there's the ability to do a conversion later on in life, which many middle and upper middle income Americans take advantage of, and they're eliminating that in the Build Back America bill.
Let's pause on that, Charlie Dombeck. KeyCityCapital.com/you. We've not talked about that before. That is a service that Americans who have provided for their retirement and are, I mean, they're 5 percenters. They're in the upper income people and they're well taken care of. They think they're fine. I hate throwing money out the window. How can you help people who think they are fine?
Two places we can really help clients. One is we help people recover dollars they unnecessarily pay in the form of federal and state income taxes. And secondarily, we help clients improve investment performance. And as a career financial services professional, as a CPA, I've evaluated thousands of clients' portfolios and tax returns. And I know that 80% of your ability to grow your wealth rapidly is dependent upon how much you pay in taxes and how well your investments perform. And we're going to volunteer to pay tax on the income that we need to live off of to cash flow our lifestyle, but work diligently to play what I call tax chess, simply moving the pieces on the board in our favor. And what we are able to do is create a lifetime annuity of savings where that annuity can be compounded into an investment program and ultimately boost the amount of income and wealth that we create over a lifetime and shorten the time it takes for us to reach a point in life where we have more freedom of choice, more ability to enjoy the things that we do, less focus on work and grinding it out.
If you want to get in touch with Charlie, you reach him at keycitycapital.com/you. Charlie, you mentioned converting IRA and 401ks to Roth. I don't know how to do that. How do you do that?
Very simply, you call up your broker who manages your capital and say, I'd like to convert a portion or all of my retirement plan dollars into a Roth account. And I have many of your listeners that we have been working with over the last several months that maybe are in a low income environment because they've retired. And we take advantage of the ability to convert when our marginal rate of taxation is low. And later on in life, when you've stopped running a business or practicing your profession, we can make tax-efficient Roth conversions. And I have three conversations today with people that have joined from your listener base about this very issue. So it's a great time of the year to consider this option because that expires on December 31 for the current year.
How expensive is it to do it?
For many people, when we make a conversion, we're paying tax at an overall marginal rate of between 15 and 20%, which is a long-term capital gain rate. I'm happy to pay taxes at 15 to 20% to create tax-free wealth for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Charlie. Charlie, are you going to work through Christmas right up to New Year's?
I am. You know, our office is shutting down for about a week, but our tax team will be working diligently through the first couple of weeks of January, because this is the time that we take care of our clients, not in April when we file our returns.
Did the IRS give a grace period this year because of COVID? They have in the past, and they ought to do it again. I just don't know if they have.
No, they haven't for the current year, and potentially with the Omicron variant, they might extend the deadline for filing in 2022, but as of yet, there has not been an extension.
Well, if you've been impressed, like many of my listeners have, with Charlie and Key City Capital, find him at keycitycapital.com/Hugh. keycitycapital.com/Hugh. Charlie, Merry Christmas to you.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, I vetted Charlie, like getting vetted. I did. I have had three full field FBI investigations in my life, and that's when they go knock on the people at Arthur Street, where I spent my first 6 years. No one remembers me on Arthur Street. Everybody's dead or moved. And you know Hugh Hewitt. Now, a full field investigation I did not do on Charlie. I'm not the FBI. But I did a lot of due diligence, because I don't recommend people to my listeners unless I trust them. And I trust Charlie. So keycitycapital.com/you. I want to encourage you to come back tomorrow, because Andrew Roberts is going to join me. I think it's the best book of the year. The Last King of America. It's all about George III. And whenever I change my opinion about someone after reading a book, I know that book has had an impact on me. George III was a constitutional monarch. He got a lot wrong about America, but he got a lot right about the British Constitution. And he's the longest serving king of England since Edward III in the 14th century. And all told, his madness, which was intermittent for most of his reign, became continuing, and it's touching and scary, but it wouldn't be treated the same way now. I hope you will listen tomorrow. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne. Thank you, Ben. I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.